This is Edge Cases, a podcast about the crumpier side of software development, mostly, but not always, Apple-related, featuring myself and my co-host, the Jekyll and Hyde of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 53. It's Friday, June 21st, 2013, and our topic this week is...
Software estimation.
Do you think you're good at software estimation?
No, that's why we're talking about it.
Okay, very good. All right, great. We didn't talk about whether you had any follow-up beforehand, but I know I'd like to start off by apologizing to our listeners for the non-notice about the lack of a show last week. So I don't know how much we should say. So basically, we just weren't ready to do a show. It was a little ambitious, I think, to do one right after WWDC ended. And so we skipped it for another week. And since we didn't really have any avenue to let everybody know, aside from recording like a little mini one, which I'm not sure would have been worth it, we only said that we weren't going to do it on our Twitter feed, which not everyone subscribes to, I'm assuming. So yeah, so I apologize for that. We're back. And hopefully there won't be any more delays and such.
Well, I think it's important that the people who don't follow us on Twitter somehow are punished. So I think this fits the bill.
All right, then. That does fit the bill. Yeah, so everybody follow us on Twitter. I will. It's Edge Cases Show on Twitter.
There might be more punishment coming up if you don't follow us on Twitter.
Okay. All right.
You've been good cop, bad cop, right?
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God, I didn't even think of it. Well, that means you're Hyde, right?
So I'm there. There we go. I never could remember which one is which.
Okay. Anything on your end?
Oh yeah, I just want to say that I met a lot of our listeners at DubDub this year.
Oh, yeah?
And I got good feedback. Well, actually, I mean, not really good feedback, like saying, no, this is how you could do things better. More just like people telling us that they enjoyed the show. So I really appreciate that. I'm still kind of surprised how many people do listen to us.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But yeah, I mean, and especially the best part was kind of getting the compliments that praise the aspects of the show that was deliberate on our part in terms of what to focus on. Like, talking about how we're not topical and that type of stuff, and right. And how we actually do talk about code and stuff like that. So, yeah, I obviously we're very kind of niche type show, but I think I really like the decisions we made, and it sounds like our audience likes them too. So I'm pretty happy with that. So thanks you all for listening.
Thank you.
And that's it. Goodbye. Oh, no, I guess we actually have a show to record.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so software estimation. So I'm going to give you a little.
So how long do you think the show is going to be?
Yeah. I estimate it's going to be another 3 seconds long. So if that follows my normal pattern of miscalculating, it should be clocking at about 45 minutes.
Yeah, it should be representative. Sure.
Right. Sure. Mm-hmm. There you go. So my experience with software estimation goes back a number of years. Probably in the mid-90s. And so Steve McConnell wrote this book called Code Complete, which I totally loved. I read it from front to back, and it definitely improved me as a programmer. And so I'm a big fan of that book. I know he has a newer version out called Code Complete 2. And Jeff Atwood also likes the Code Complete book so much that he stole the little coding horror like icon that he would use to kind of graphically enrich the book as his like avatar. Okay. So that's actually where it comes from. But I liked the Code Complete before it was cool. So there we go. and so Steve McConnell wrote this other book called Rapid Development. And I was just pretty much kind of like doing Mac programming for fun at that point and kind of web programming for fun. And I had a client, and I had kind of like fell into this programming gig where he's like, oh, I want you to build this web storefront, and we need to do these really weird kind of shipping things in order to pull it off, and could you do it? And I'm like, crap, this is actually like a professional thing, right? And I'm just used to like coding for myself. So I'm like, you know, I need to kind of step up the plate here and like be quote-unquote professional. So I don't remember if I think I read the book Rapid Development before that, but didn't really have too much use for it because I was kind of just coding for myself, kind of playing around. But I end up kind of delving into that book again and feeling like, okay, I need to become more professional about this. I need to not just kind of bolt things together. I need to act like an adult about this. So I'm going to do the book a disservice here because I looked at the table of contents and it covers a lot more than I remember. But I do remember what I kind of like got out of it and what my direction was after reading that book is that I was really focusing on two things. And that was kind of speccing things out ahead of time, kind of speccing out what this website should do. And then basically assigning risk to things, like how risky the various things are, and kind of like creating this checklist of all the things that should do, and then how risky each part was. And the client was pretty new to software development as well. I think actually I might have been the first guy he ever hired to like write custom software, so he was new to all this too. So he was willing to play ball with me in that way, and so he went ahead, and it really went badly. In terms of, I mean, I shipped the software, but it didn't really go as I had hoped. I thought it'd be smooth sailing, that you know we can catch a risk up front and we'd follow this back and all that. And so it was really my first attempt to try to kind of do things professionally, and it didn't get done well at all. I think the original spec thought I would be done in like a month, and it took me 3 months. So, I mean, 3x is actually not nearly as bad as a lot of software projects, but it felt pretty crummy for me. So yeah. It was not a good experience for me. So, Andrew, have you experienced this failing utterly at software estimation like I have?
Sure, let me admit that to all of my potential peers and employers. Right. But yes, it's a really well-known fact, and I have fallen into that as well. I think just today I told my manager, okay, this will take an hour, and it took 3 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said something would take a half an hour, and it took an hour. So yeah, it's pretty endemic. And I guess we can talk about exactly why, but yes, it has happened to me both in small scale stuff, like I just said, and larger scale stuff when you say, well, okay, that'll take me a month. Right. Mm. And I know we'll see what you have to say as part of this. I think a lot of schedules manage to stay on track by hiding part of that development time in the bug fixing time.
I didn't have much success with Jeff Edwards' kind of way of doing things. But I've found a new guru that for software estimation, and I think you've heard of him. Is Donald Rumsfeld?
Oh God! Yes, I believe I've heard of him.
Yes, and I like to quote from. It's not really a book on it, and it's actually almost a form of poetry, but. But I would like to quote from him here, and actually this is how much of a guru he is on software estimation that I think this is all he's written on it. So so I'll read it to you here. As we know, there are known knowns. These are the things we know. We also know there are no known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. Thank you.
Well, if you put it in the 4x4, you know, well, 2x2 grid, which one are we missing? Because you just did three of them.
You know, you're such a programmer. Yes, you filled out your truth tables and you realize things are missing. Yeah.
Well, we're missing the unknown knowns.
Right, the unknown knowns.
The things that you know, but that you don't know that you know.
Very good.
We probably won't have to deal with those very much.
Right. I think maybe that's why he took literary license. And he didn't include that in his 2x2 grid.
Well, so is the title of this episode the poetry of Donald Rumsfeld?
Now that you said it, it very well could be.
Very well could be, yes. Okay.
That was a little bit hard to follow, but actually I'm glad you brought up the 2x2 grid and actually kind of made it a little bit more geometrically understandable. But Uh-huh. But yeah, so it's the idea is that software is a creation type thing. It's there was this big thrust, I want to say, in maybe the late 80s, early 90s, maybe more throughout the 90s, about, you know, if we only, you know, the idea of the software factory, right? That you have your inputs and you have your outputs, and these beautiful shiny bits come rolling off the assembly line, and it's just we can throw science at this. And unfortunately, it seems to be more of a creative act, because the weird thing about software is that, I mean, you look at factories, and it's a matter of stamping out things, right? That we know what to do to reproduce things, because living in the physical world, we need to have, you know, if I'm going to have an iPhone and you're going to have an iPhone, that means we need two iPhones. So we need to have clones. We need to have these factories that stamp out identical things. And when you have identical things, you have economies of scale, and that's great. And the problem with software is that we have essentially no economies of scale. And that's kind of because of what software is. Because it's infinitely copyable bits, we, you know, if I have a copy of CP and you have a copy of CP, or wait, I mean, I should say cat. What, CP. Well,
CP, sure.
Yeah. So the file copying program on Unix, right? And, you know, we don't need that. Those bits have been copied, and those didn't need to be CP. There doesn't need to be an elf somewhere that, you know, crafted a CP for me and then crafted a CP for you. It's just copied, right? It was written once and then can be infinitely duplicated. And so it's also, so if I actually need to write a program, or if I need to copy a file, I just can use CP. It's not that I have to build my own CP, that's so I can copy a file. I just can use it. And so almost by definition, all the software we write is software that we don't have yet, that needs to be created.
They're singletons.
Right, exactly. They're everything is one-off, and so we don't get anything near the economies of scale. And so, yeah, I could go on and on about kind of the rot of our profession, but but
I'm sure you could.
But I'll set that aside, because I want to kind of keep on track on the software estimation. So I want to say it is a fairly unique problem, that everything we create is kind of these one-offs. And even if you've written a program that's very similar to another program, even if you've written the same program essentially twice, there can be little gotchas, and it tends to be easier to tweak an existing program, but it can be surprisingly difficult as well. In fact, one of my favorite articles here was written by Brent Simmons on it, and he was and it's on his blog. It's called "The Nonlinear Relationship of Coding Effort and Results." I don't know if you remember reading this article, blog posting, I guess, but his basic thrust, and I really like his metaphor. That he was talking about how he was trying to optimize this operation, that it should take about maybe 50K to run in, and it was taking about 100 megabytes of RAM. So 10 minutes later, he had it down to 4 megabytes, and then he needed to shave off another 4 megabytes, and it took 10 minutes to reduce memory usage by 96 megabytes. And if there was a linear relationship, that should take under half a minute, so, and less than 30 seconds to go the rest of the way. But that's not how it works. And his metaphor there is that it's as if you have 100 bags of leaves to carry out to the curb, and each bag will take about the same amount of time as the others. So it's almost as if you carried out the 96 bags of leaves did that easily and quickly. But you realize, in order to get out those last 4 bags, even though they're exactly the same as all the others, you first have to pour a new driveway.
Right? I do remember that metaphor, yeah.
Yes, I love that metaphor, because and his closest last sentence here is like, which is crazy, right? If the real world were operate like that all the time, we'd go completely nuts. And yeah, but that's how...
Maybe we have.
Exactly. So it's... It tends to be kind of this nonlinear type thing, and I think it has great impact on software estimation. That said,
if I can get in there for a second, it's interesting because those 4 bags are not like the other 96 bags.
Oh yeah,
that might also be a way to take that discussion that you might think they are, because the numbers are the same, but the actual amount of the kind of effort required for your human brain to do to fix that problem is different for those two. And that may be why you can't think of it that way. That's why it's not a good metaphor.
No, oh, well, I'm all about plying you with bad metaphors so you can shoot them down.
There you go.
So,
but keep going. Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to talk about a little bit about coping mechanisms for this type of stuff. And
So we're past analysis and on to coping.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be nice if we did a shorter episode for a change. So
yeah, sure.
But
drink.
There we go. For the best thing I've actually read on this is something that has been since disowned. Was written by Joel Spolsky. And I don't know if you remember reading this when it came out, but it was called Painless Software Schedules.
Ooh, I don't remember the title, but keep going.
But his big thing was he had a bunch of insights, and he's now, if you go to the article now, it says at the front saying, "This article is obsolete. Over the years, I've learned a lot more about schedules and estimates. A newer, far better method for providing accurate methods, an accurate software schedules painlessly, is evidence-based scheduling." Please read that instead. This article remains here for archival purposes, but please don't read it. So I'm going to do him the additional dishonor of actually telling you what the article reads.
Right.
And tell you why I really like it. And then also talk about why he thinks it's obsolete. And his basic thrust for his painless software schedules is you break features into a
set of... There's a lot of thrusting going on in this episode.
I didn't want to say anything. You break features into a set of tasks to be done. And one of the very important things here is to make these tasks fine-grained. That and ideally, they should be on the order of hours, and definitely not more than a day. And but you saw that even with your estimates today, when you said something would take half an hour, took an hour, you said it would take an hour, take three, right? Even with these very fine-grained, where you think you got to handle something, even with these fine-grained estimates, you went 3x over. That's very easily. So you can imagine why if you say that, oh, that would take a week to do, that gives you even more slack to shoot yourself in the foot. He recommends creating like an Excel spreadsheet because he's a big Excel guy, but you could use any spreadsheet.
Right.
And you can you write out your series of tasks and you assign them estimates for each feature. You assign the estimate, the original estimate, and then you also have a current estimate, because chances are, as you work on something, your current estimate will end up diverging from your original estimate. As you get deeper into the problem, you realize, oh, there's this thing I hadn't considered. So you end up updating that. And you also have a time elapsed column. And you just and this simple system of kind of this like three numbers and these fine-grained tasks, actually, in my experience, have been the best estimation tools I've used to date. And in modern times here, I actually have an Omni Outliner document for this type of stuff. And back when I was doing software estimation, which I'll talk about a little bit later, and this is how I would kind of like estimate how big a project was. I'd bring up Omni Outliner document, I'd say what feature you want, and kind of create a list of 20 of them, then I break down the tasks, and I'd then produce a fairly big number. I say, this is what I think it will be, and then we'd roll from there. And now that I think about it, like all the estimates that I created, I don't think any of them matched in terms of just like really what the was one of the problems with this is that I don't think the features that we kind of called out in the initial consultation matched anywhere close to the features that we end up shipping. So right there is a big, big problem with that. But so painless software schedules, it's very simple to do, and I think probably the most easily enlightening type of technique you can use to kind of explore this problem space. Now, I did mention that he said that the article is obsolete and you shouldn't use it, and he's now moved on to something that he calls evidence-based scheduling, where he has very much the same thing, where you kind of like have a list of things you need to work on, and the difference is that you track elapsed time, and you do to figure out what your velocity is, which I'll also talk about a little bit later. And then you run Monte Carlo simulations to try and figure out where this actually will land. So it's kind of like it mixes a time tracking program with a project management program mixed with a bug tracker type thing. Because as you mentioned, it's important. He mentions it's very important to charge bugs to the original feature, so that you can't do that kind of like squish on a piece of on a blob of mercury and it squishes out the other side. It's that it all gets, you know, kind of rolled back into the original feature. And so he says that's pretty good estimation, and it all sounds very good in theory. I've never used it in reality because I have since moved on to another coping strategy, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But so have you actually ever had to produce like a list of estimates, Andrew? Like actually, you know, something that was more detailed versus just like an hour? Yeah. Oh, it take me an hour to do that.
Sure. When I was working at places that were contracting houses, of course you need an estimate because your manager is going to tell the client how long you think it's going to take, and so that was always important there. It was actually nice to get out of that world and go to Apple, where that was no longer quite the same. Like they still wanted to know how long stuff was going to take, but they weren't quite as strict about it. Because there wasn't a client, you know, tapping their foot for every second that you spent on it, and so I actually found that to be quite a relief. I would create large scale estimates of what I thought I was going to do at Apple, and then never hear about them again, which was kind of the right way to go about it. Because if we had tried to reconcile, and maybe we'll get to this later, if you tried to reconcile later, the original schedule you made with what you actually did. That winds up being, a really big merge problem because, you wind up spending a little bit more time on this. You found an extra task that had to go here and this and that and that. So if you really try to do that afterwards, it doesn't work. You may have more luck if you try to keep it up to date incrementally as you go.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I've seen that maybe is a little bit of a better use of estimates is like just a bug estimate. So instead of trying to estimate how long an entire task is going to be, you only start using sort of hour-long estimates when you're down to individual bugs.
Hmm.
And that even it's not so much, well, am I getting that exactly right? It's more giving management a way to know about how much work there is left.
Mm-hmm.
And also letting management know, okay, this bug is going to be a problem because you say it's going to take 2 days. And, whether it takes 2 days or 4 days, that might be a problem if you've only got a week left,
mm-hmm.
So that would be, criteria for punting bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my real world experience with estimates. That's really the only place where it gets used consistently and thoroughly. And it, it works okay there.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's kind of like the deadline way of looking at the projects, right? Because you got to ship for dub, right? Or whatever.
Right.
And yeah. So And that's definitely. I'll talk about a little bit about that later in my coping mechanism. One interesting aspect of this. Well, tell you what, I'll just jump to it now because it fits in with what we're talking about. I don't want to lose too much context. So my coping strategy for this is that I basically have given up trying to estimate software, and I did this a number of years ago. Just give up, and when a client contacts me and says, I want to write this program, and I tell them, that's an interesting program. I'll be happy to write that for you, and I don't know how long it's going to take me. And you don't know how long it's going to take me, or you don't know how long it will take anyone to write it, because you don't know what the software really should do yet. And instead, I say, what you should do is you should buy me for a week. And I will work on your software for a week, and I will give you a deliverable. And then you can see where we're out there. I can tell you what work still needs to be done. And then you can decide whether you want to buy me for another week. And so essentially it boils down to weekly deliverables. And it tends to be much more iterative.
And right. Is there a name for this? There's something where you don't do the – it's not waterfall, then it's something.
I want to call it continuous delivery. And that kind of matches with what people often do, like GitHub does, for example, for their website, right? Is like they have their master branch, and people are merging into it all the time. And what's on master gets run through some automated tests, and if all signs are go, then it's pushed out that day. So this continuous adding to thing. It's really kind of the flip side of the Stephen McConnell kind of way of looking at it from his rapid development book, right? His idea of managing risk is that you should nail things down and that way you could tell the stakeholders know, let them know, now this is what could go wrong, and so they could make supposedly their good business decisions. I guess my bitterness kind of soaks in there a little bit when I said supposedly, but.
It doesn't work. I mean, we know it doesn't work.
Right. And that's part of it. Whereas with the week at a time type thing, it's like, yes, there's still tons of risk going on. Things are going to fail. But chances are each week the software will be a little bit better the way of managing risk is they get to decide when to say stop. And the idea is that
adjust better.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the idea is that their way of managing risk is that they'll have an app in a week. It won't do very much at all, and it won't look good, but it will get continuously better. And when they say enough is enough, they turn me off. This has been pretty successful for me in terms of giving up on trying to estimate how long things will take. I will say that there are probably two major downsides that I run into. And the first one is that if you have a project that has significant technical risks where you have to like develop a new, like, I don't know, optical imaging engine that like can like look at the camera and do computer vision stuff or something, like that could easily take a month of research, right? That is something that is not conducive to this type of iterative model.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You might be able to break down that into mini milestones, or just work on it. We could say this is the type of computer science problem that needs to be solved, or to make this happen at all. But basically, for big kind of leap stuff or big stuff, this type of model doesn't really fit that. That said, there's tons of, I would say most software is applicable to this kind of like weekly deliverable type of model. Because most software doesn't require huge innovation. It just requires kind of bolting things together and writing a bunch of glue code. Mm-hmm. The other problem with that big technical risk is that not only can it take longer than a week, but that type of progress is often invisible. That if I'm grinding away on some new innovative thing, and I am saying, yes, I'm still working on it, and because it's like all software, it's something we haven't written before, but this is in addition that I'm wondering if it even could be written in the first place. That's another, that could be a big pill to swallow. And so if the best thing is to find a client who kind of needs it or is at least understanding about what they're asking to be done. And hopefully your reputation can carry you through into you actually ship or fail.
Absolutely. So the two things that I think of about that is there's certainly like Apple going to the yearly release cycle for its OSs, right?
Mm-hmm.
One problem with that is what if they have a big thing that they need to do that's going to take longer than a year?
Right.
And I know that one of the design philosophies that was espoused in my presence when I was at Apple was the idea that, okay, sure, you can do something where the final payoff is 2 years away or 3 years away, but you have to deliver something for this release. Like you have to split up the whole task such that we get some concrete benefit from it in the interim. And they did that because they didn't want you going off all on your own for a year and not doing anything. They wanted to make sure that you were accountable to some fashion for this, but it makes it difficult because maybe what you're working on, you know, you can't figure it out that way, or maybe making a deliverable out of it in the middle means you're wasting quite a bit of time that you wouldn't otherwise have to waste if you weren't going to do that. But so I know that made some engineers unhappy, but that was certainly one of the philosophies they had. The other thing though that to me makes sense about that is that it helps with human nature, because one thing that I found, I think both in myself and in others, is that if you give someone a long lead time for something where, okay, it's going to take you a month to do this. All right, so I'm going to let you go for a month and do that. Well, you know, they're probably not going to work quite as hard the first 2 weeks or even the first 3 weeks as that final week, because you think, oh, I have all this time to do this thing. So in some ways, having intermediate deliverables or intermediate something where you can say, okay, yes, we need to hit this in a week. Someone else is going to need to see something in a week. Someone else is going to judge me for what I've been doing. I think it really does help with, you know, as opposed to with like robots or whatever, programming robots, because humans get a little lazy, get a little, they want to take, you know, ease off a bit. Now, but the other side of that is if you have deliverables which are really, really aggressive and that you know, basically we set things up so that you're working all out all the time, of course, then you're just going to burn yourself out. Mm-hmm. So you need to find some sweet spot in the middle of that to get it to the point where you're not putting things off unnecessarily, but you're also not well, it's like one thing that they talk about in like Agile, I believe, is sprints,
right?
You have you know, short sprints of like 2 weeks or whatever, and you know, you have to be sure that those aren't taken literally, that you're not at a dead run, you know, the entire time for all of every sprint you're at, because that's not sustainable.
Right. Yeah, it's it really reminds me of that the optimum failure rate is about 50%, that 50% of the things you should try, you should fail at, otherwise you're not growing. But if you're failing more than that, then you're probably, you know, you're taking too many risks.
That would be a little hard to explain to the business folks.
You think?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to try that. Don't worry, my last client failed, so I'm sure you won't fail.
You won't, right?
Yeah. And you're right, with the scope thing, and if you try to do those non-ambitious projects, which is what I'm kind of get at, is that you probably can do, you know, you write your little shell scripts or what have you that are really low risk, pretty low effort, and you can knock them out pretty much all day, every day, and you can always make your estimates, right? And it's really in the kind of the reaching and trying to go a little bit beyond is where you intend to entail the most risk and where you're going to more uncharted territory,
right?
And the more complicated stuff that we tend to write. And yeah, so it's in that way, you actually, it's almost a sign of health where you're kind of going beyond your estimates that you're actually potentially, because obviously this would be going horribly wrong too, but it could be a sign of health where you actually are writing software that's appropriately complicated and pushing the field forward enough that to make a dent.
When there's quite a bit wrong with the startup culture, some of which I've seen firsthand.
Sure.
But certainly the fact that in Silicon Valley, failure is not considered a career-ending occurrence is a good thing, because it's like you said, people are willing to be more ambitious because they know they can bounce back from things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Okay. Well, that does it for me. I have a few other things I skipped over, but I think this is a good place to leave it.
The other thing that I'll say, though, is one story that I heard at Apple, and I don't know the person involved, but so maybe he's listening. Hi, he or she. But one thing I heard was that someone decided that their way of handling all of these issues was just to say for every task they were ever given, whatever it was, it'll take a week. And they actually did it. And then at the end of like a year, they went back over it and they said, hey, was that accurate? Well, you know, it worked out. In the aggregate, that worked out.
So those hour tasks that he totally overestimated on.
We're totally compensated for by, you know, the giant things that he said was a week and was actually a month.
Yeah, tying this back to weirdly, I guess I mentioned both Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky in this episode, but they had the the podcast, the Stack Overflow podcast, while they're developing it. And Jeff Atwood was famous for telling for estimating to Joel, you know, obviously Joel has put in a lot of time and effort into thinking about software estimation, all that. And he would ask Jeff for an estimate, and he said 3 to 6 weeks. Of course, Stack Overflow ended up taking probably, I think it was 4 to 6 months or something like that. Right. But this actually kind of turned Joel around on it, that it actually didn't matter how much time this thing would take. Obviously, you know, obviously if it's taking 30 to 40 years, yeah, that's a problem. But practically, this is they were adequately capitalized, and they were doing an interesting project that they both wanted to do. And so the fact that it ran way over was actually not a problem, and it took the appropriate amount of time.
Yep.
Yeah. So that does it for me.
Okay, great. Please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And I suppose you'll have to see if this episode actually ends in a song, because I don't know yet if it will. But if it does or if it doesn't, we will see you next time.